The talk tonight is all about inner wealth. The main reason for meditating is to become conscious of those areas of mind which are unconscious. It is these unconscious aspects which drive us to do, to say, and to think in certain set patterns. Some of these patterns are healthy, therefore bring happiness in their wake. Others are unhealthy, causing us distress. Without the decision to make these unconscious areas of mind conscious, they just ramble on, ad infinitum, running down the same old grooves that they have worn over many lifetimes, making us do, say, and think things we'd rather not. Usually, the only part of the process that we are conscious of is the end result. That is, that sometimes we are sad, or depressed, or irritable, and sometimes we are happy, or excited, or tranquil. Why these states pop into mind, we have no idea. For the vast majority of mankind's population, becoming conscious of their unconscious areas is of little interest. They don't see the profit in it. They only see that more is to be gained from obtaining wealth. That wealth will take the form of acquiring talents, either educational, artistic, or sporting talents, or it will take the form of accumulating property, TVs, cars, children, social position, etc. Increasing one's talents or increasing one's material goods is to add to oneself. This adding is the way of external wealth. It is the way external wealth is built up. After one talent or material possession has been acquired, then the person sets their sights on the next possession. Each possession added to oneself is seen as increasing one's happiness. If it just so happens one doesn't get happiness with the last possession, well, never mind, happiness is promised just over the horizon with the next new possession. That new dishwasher, or the new promotion at work, or the new house, or the new evening class. Adding things to one as being the only way to happiness is the firm belief that runs at a very deep level throughout all societies. A few people in the world become conscious of the fact that no matter how many university degrees they get, or how many pictures they paint, or how many cars they acquire, somehow total all-consuming happiness still eludes them, and all they're left with is a nagging sense of emptiness. Some dismiss it and cover it up with drink or drugs or parties or political causes. Some do not ignore it. They decide that there must be a way to finding out what this nagging emptiness is. These few will then undertake a psychological or spiritual discipline to make conscious that nagging emptiness. These few have begun their journey from unconsciousness to consciousness, from sleep to awakeness. These few have begun their journey towards inner wealth. Talents and goods are outer wealth. These few already have outer wealth, even if, by most people's standards, they are as poor as church mice. They are externally wealthy because they have come to see the limitations of outer wealth. However, as they outgrow the need to focus all their attention on outer wealth, they now find themselves perched on the edge of a vast empty chasm. That emptiness exists because they have no inner wealth. Their inner store cupboard is bare. It has no goods in it. If externally they are wealthy, but internally they are poor, this sets up an imbalance, which they now become acutely aware of, and set about to rectify. The laws that govern the acquiring of inner wealth are quite different from those that govern the acquiring of external wealth. We are raised from childhood to adulthood absorbing the rules that govern the acquiring of external wealth. But how to obtain inner wealth? That sort of conditioning just isn't there. So we go through quite a stressful time at the beginning of our inner training, because we approach it in the same way as we do to acquire outer wealth. Our very first task is to learn to leave behind the laws that govern the outer world, not drag them through into this new universe that we're trying to learn about. Once we have mastered that, then we can begin learning the rules that govern the acquiring of inner wealth. This wealth takes the form of becoming conscious of mind and the way in which mind operates. In order to become conscious of mind, one has to let go. One has to let go of thinking, let go of ill will, let go of calm, let go of sleepiness, let go of tension. Letting go is the main law governing inner wealth, and it is quite opposite to the law governing outer wealth. The law governing outer wealth is that of acquiring and hanging on. It's no wonder we struggle when we come to build inner wealth. We want to continue that pattern of acquiring. So instead of letting go of ill will, as an example, we keep it and add to it by overlaying it with love. But it is not true love. What we normally call love is nothing other than possessiveness. True love is that state which is present when we let go of ill will. Let me give you an example of letting go. We have a meditator who has been meditating for many years and who's very skilled at Vipassana meditation. Some years back, he was on a meditative retreat with us, and in those days, the road outside the House of Inner Tranquility was plagued by motorbike enthusiasts. So at frequent intervals throughout the day, there'd be this sudden, shrill, piercing sound as a motorbike engine would tear either up the hill or down the hill. On one of these occasions, he noticed running through the mind a series of pictures. And in those pictures, he saw himself opening a window in the corridor, the one next to the shoe bench. Then he saw himself get up on the windowsill and crouch there, with machine gun in hand, and he proceeded to gun down every motorbike as it went past. That was followed by a series of pictures with the same theme of getting rid of the noisy motorbikes. But in these images, instead of using a machine gun, he was laying huge tacks across the road to spike the wheels of the motorbikes as they went past. These pictures popped into his mind, lasted for a while, and then were gone. And he laughed. He recognized that such pictures were typical of his character, that such images ran through his mind from time to time. It was his response to those pictures that was interesting. He was not disturbed by them. He didn't start hating himself for having such violent images. He did not say to himself, "I shouldn't be like this," and start criticizing and tearing himself apart. Nor did he play around with them and get passionately worked up with an enjoyment of them. He placed no value judgment of good or bad upon those images. To him, they were just a series of objects that rose and fell in mind. And because he did not respond with either hate or lust towards them, they were like empty shells that just paraded past the mind's eye. He did not take them seriously at all. Because that meditator did not rise up with either lust or hate at the sight of those images, his mind remained undisturbed. It remained still. It remained peaceful. It remained harmless, even though the objects passing through would be given the label violent. It's one's response to internal objects which is critical. If there is a wanting for them to remain, or a desire to get rid of them, then there is attachment. When there is attachment, there is a refusal to let the object go. And this refusal to let it go and pass out of existence causes a great rend, a great pain in the mind. And that is what is known as dukkha. Let me tell you another story about letting go. In the past, in some countries of the East, the merchant was not highly regarded. He was thought to be dominated by selfish profit and lacking in the inner strength of the warrior class. Also, he was regarded as lacking in the calm of the priestly caste. A young warrior got to know a merchant in his city. There was something about the man's character which attracted him. Once he went to sympathize after the merchant had suffered a big loss, but found the merchant undisturbed. Another time, when he knew that a minister had made important purchases from the merchant, he observed that when they met, the merchant did not mention the matter at all. One day they were walking together. They saw a fire and helped to rescue the family. The merchant, showing a calm daring which impressed the warrior, who said afterwards, "You will excuse me saying this, but it was rather unexpected to see you calmly taking such risks. I had thought that came from the way of the warrior." "Oh," replied the friend, "merchants have a way of their own. I suppose you pray to the god Ganesh to protect you. All merchants worship the Lord of Prosperity." "I do worship Ganesha, but I never ask for anything." To pray for things is all right for little merchants who are not yet on our way. However much a merchant may own, if he prays for things, he is only a little merchant. If I prayed for something, I should always be anxiously wondering whether my prayer would be answered or not. That would disturb my mind. It would disturb my heart. And no one with a disturbed heart can be a great merchant. "Please tell me about your way," asked the warrior. The merchant looked serious and said, "Words are no use in explaining the way, but I can show you. A little further on there is a shop where the owner is ignorant but cunning. When a great man dies, he immediately goes to the house and makes an attractive offer for small things in the dead man's effects. Often the relative thinks them of no value, and in the confusion he may get a good bargain. But he himself does not know the value of the things either. He waits till a prospective buyer comes in and then takes his cue from how much interest the customer shows. When he sees me coming, he will be on the alert, because he knows I am well informed in such things. He has in his shop at present a little box which is really valuable, because it is one of a set with a long history, and this set has got dispersed over the ages. He bought it cheap from an old widow who knew nothing about it. I have the others, and this one would complete the set. Of course, I could send an agent to buy it, but a great merchant never does anything like that. He goes himself, without any tricks." When they got to the shop, the merchant looked around a little and then inquired, "How much for this box?" The proprietor looked narrowly at him and named a high price. "What," smiled the merchant, "for that little box? It might be one of a set, perhaps." "I'm not buying a set. I should not pay more than a quarter of what you're asking. Even that would probably be much more than you paid for it." "Well, I have no concern for it. Keep it." And he walked away down the street with his friend. As they rounded the corner, talking cheerfully of other things, the shop owner came running after them. "I have always had a great respect for you, and I have decided to let you have it at a quarter of my price, just as you wanted. But I hope you will remember this gesture of friendship." The merchant paid without comment and took the box. Afterwards, the warrior said, "But you told me a great merchant never uses tricks. That was nothing but a trick. Nothing but a trick." "Do you think so? Let us see whether it was or not. Is there anything in any shop which you have had your eye on for some time. Yes, there's an old sword in a shop near here. It must have belonged to one of the noble Rajput families because the hilt is very small. We pride ourselves on our small hands. Our enemies may take the weapons from our dead bodies, but they cannot use them. I should like that sword very much, but I doubt whether I could afford it. Well, you can try the trick then. I will leave you. Come in and see me afterwards. When they met again, the warrior was looking downcast. It didn't work, he said. I did exactly what you did. I told him I wouldn't pay more than a quarter what he asked, and that I had no concern with it. I'm sure that he does not know the real value of it, but he didn't come after me. I kept hoping he would, but he didn't. It would have been wonderful to have had that sword in my family. It's one of the old swords. Then you are still concerned with it, aren't you? I told you words are no good in the way. Now sit here and give up that sword. Give it up completely. They sat in silence for a time, and then the warrior said quietly, I can't. Tell me how to do it. The merchant replied, For the sake of honor, you would be willing to give up your life in the way of the warrior. But this is the way of the merchant. Every day I sit before the image of Ganesha, and I meditate that all around me, my shop, my goods, my house, and my warehouses, everything I have has caught fire and is burning away. Even my body catches fire. The whole world catches fire and burns until everything is ashes. Then there is only Ganesha and I and Ganesha, Ganesha and I. That is all there is. Perhaps there is something still further, but it can't be spoken. One day a friend said to the young warrior, Why do you go around with that merchant? You are a warrior and he is a merchant. He's an honest merchant, I'll admit, but still just a merchant after all. He certainly acts like one, was the reply, but I don't know that he is just a merchant. It seems to me sometimes that it is not really a merchant there at all, but Ganesha playing at being a merchant. That merchant, by practicing a form of concentration meditation, had learnt how to let go of attachment to material goods. The whole purpose of placing the mind on rise and fall time and time again is to develop a skill of being conscious of an object in the moment. When you place the mind on rise and fall, not only are you developing the skill of being conscious in the moment, but also you are developing the skill of narrowing the focus of the mind onto one object. The former is known as mindfulness, the latter as concentration. The skill of concentration and being awake in the present is being developed on a neutral object. Rise and fall is neutral. We can't get too worked up about it. We're not passionately in love with it, nor do we passionately hate it. We don't have any feeling towards it. Therefore, it's neutral. And as it's neutral, it's a good object to use for developing the skill of both concentration and mindfulness. Having developed that skill, we can't help but find it operating towards objects that normally we would choose to be unconscious of, objects such as jealousy, envy, or loneliness. Normally, we relegate these unpleasant objects down to the level of unconsciousness. We do this just by ignoring them. Pretending we don't experience jealousy, we'll say, I'm not the jealous type. But when the skill of being conscious is trained in, we find we are incapable of ignoring these unpleasant objects, such as jealousy, any longer. Now, just being aware of them is not sufficient to take the sting out of them. Being aware is step one in the process of acquiring inner wealth. Step two is seeing what causes the arising and the ceasing of objects. For example, let's imagine that you've gone to a gathering. It's a psychics and alternative medicine fair. There are all sorts of stalls at this fair, some dealing with health, some with diet, some with exercise, others dealing with hypnotherapy, homeopathy, acupuncture, tarot, yoga, astrology, and meditation. Apart from the stalls, there are restaurants where you can purchase a tasty snack, and there's a hall where lectures are given every hour. You attend one of these lectures, one on meditation, and after the lecture, you strike up a conversation with the person sitting next to you. He, like you, meditates, but he belongs to a different group. He's heard via the grapevine of the group you belong to, and has some rather strong antagonistic views to express on the type of meditation you're practicing and the style of instruction your teacher uses. You're very upset. You've been mindful of the conversation. You've been mindful of your reaction to the conversation. You've watched anger arise, but the watching isn't good enough. Just to be aware of anger and indignation, to be aware that these two are present, is just not enough. You need to be aware of what the anger arose upon. And if you say that it arose because the person you were in conversation with said some unpleasant things about the meditation you practice, then you would be wrong. Sure, he said some unkind things, but they were only words. Those words are only objects accompanied by an unpleasant feeling. And an object accompanied by an unpleasant feeling is not anger. So why did you choose to respond to his words with anger? Anger is suffering. Why did you choose to suffer? Anger arose dependent upon identification. You viewed what was being said in terms of my meditation system, my group, my teacher. If the person had said something nasty about a system of meditation that you don't practice, or had said something nasty about the teacher in the next village, it wouldn't have bothered you. You probably would have laughed and enjoyed the put-down of the other teacher. But dependent upon identification, which is viewing the group, the meditation system, the teacher as mine, dependent upon that identification arises anger. The anger does not arise dependent upon unpleasant words being spoken by someone else, but upon a craving to get rid of the unpleasant feeling that accompanied those unpleasant words. And the unpleasant feeling arose because of regarding the meditation system and the teacher as mine. And when there is no clear seeing, one doesn't notice that there is a craving to get rid of an unpleasant feeling. All that is missed, and the wrong connection is made, and the conclusion is drawn that it's Mr. Smith's unpleasant words that are causing me pain. Therefore, it's Mr. Smith's fault, which is absolute nonsense. It's not Mr. Smith who's caused me to suffer. I've caused myself to suffer by identification. That craving to get rid of breeds the resistance to the words being spoken. If it's something disparaging said about some other group, then there is no identification, therefore no resistance. If I identify and regard it as my group, my meditation, my teacher, then there is resistance to the flow of reality, and suffering arises. It is important to see, to be mindful of what suffering arises upon. If you are more than just mindful of ill will present, or envy present, or jealousy present, if you are also mindful of what ill will, jealousy, or envy arise upon, then and only then have you a chance of letting go of ill will. Only once you let go do you find that you have inner wealth. As long as there's a hanging on to hatred, to bitterness, to how the world should behave, etc., one's inner universe is empty. It's hollow. It's only filled with richness when objects are allowed to pass through. Hanging on to any one of those fleeting objects brings instant poverty. But by letting go, even for a moment, starts the building of inner wealth. If you take your right hand and you flick your index finger against your left hand wrist, there'll be a stinging sensation. Do you want to try it? Try it now. Just do that. We'll wake you all up, if nothing else. Okay. You did it hard enough, I hope. Now, that sensation is painful. But you didn't suffer. You didn't suffer just because you experienced an unpleasant object. Why? If a memory of a row with your wife, or your husband, or your child, or your parent, if that floats across your mind, you suffer. Why? Both the stinging sensation and the memory of the row are unpleasant objects. The stinging sensation is painful, but no suffering follows in its wake. The memory of the row is also painful, but you suffer. Why should that be? It is because you put a value judgment on one. You put a value judgment on the row. As far as you are concerned, you do not wish to experience the unpleasant feeling that the memory of the row arouses. That unpleasant feeling is pain. There is no problem with pain. But if you do not want to experience that pain, then instantly you have a problem. What the mind does is to compare between what you are experiencing in the moment, which is pain, and what you would prefer to experience in the moment, which is non-pain. The instant the mind compares, there is suffering. With the stinging sensation, there is no value judgment. You do not mind the stinging, even though, according to the rules of what constitutes an unpleasant object, you must call it unpleasant. Because you do not mind the unpleasant stinging sensation, you do not compare it with what you would prefer to experience. Because you do not compare, you do not hang on to the stinging sensation. You let go of it. You let go of an object. You stay in the moment. With the stinging sensation, you were aware and totally accepting of the moment. When you can do that, then there's no suffering. If there's no suffering, then no grasping of an object took place. When there's no grasping at something, there is a letting life live, letting it flow. There is a term for letting life flow. It's called love. There's a little book that's going into the library, and it's called How to Choose a Guru. It claims to be an A to Z guide on telling the real from the false. It deals with each letter of the alphabet and covers various topics under each letter. For example, under the letter C, such subjects as clairvoyance, compassion, consciousness are dealt with, along with a few others. Under H is healing, honeymoon, humility. So it was with some interest I looked under M, for I wanted to see what he had to say about meditation. And sure enough, the author, whose name's Rick Chapman, who claims incidentally to be a seeker, not a guru, he has dealt with meditation, as well as perfect masters, Mahababa, Milarepa, ministers, miracles, and money. What he has to say about meditation is very interesting. He says that the perfect master does not teach meditation. He teaches love. And he's very correct in that statement. The brief statement I've just made is it's actually a summary of what Mr. Chapman's essay on meditation has to say. His essay covers two paragraphs, and it has lots of delightful little gems in it. Little gems like, no meditation can in itself take the seeker to the goal. The perfect master, and his definition of the perfect master, is one who is enlightened. The perfect master is a meditation himself. Though he may give a particular form of meditation to his followers, it is for them to use for a limited time. He does not give such practices an inherent importance. He knows that the highest and the most effective meditation is love. Let me explain what is meant by the perfect master only teaches love. Have you ever been in love? I don't make the assumption that you have been in love just because you're married or because you're living with someone. Many a person goes through their whole life never having experienced true love. They may well have experienced something which they call love, but it isn't. It's possessiveness. I will explain what love is, dare I be so bold, and you can decide whether or not you have experienced it. Let's imagine you're a woman. You fall in love with a man. When you're in that state of mind, your mind is completely open. It's soft. It's accepting. It's non-judgmental. If your partner smiles at you, you love it. If he shouts at you, you love it. If he stands on his head and does funny things in the air with his legs, you love it. If he has bandy legs, you don't care. You think they're beautiful anyhow. If he says something nasty and it hurts you, you bounce back instantly, not with a cutting remark, but with a mind that is open, that is soft, accepting of the hurt, only too delighted to be with him, regardless of what he says or does. When the mind is in love, it registers hurt. It totally experiences hurt. It doesn't deny it. It doesn't squash it out. It experiences it, and it still stays open and soft. This sort of openness can be seen in a dog. If you own a dog, you may have noticed that you can shout at it, you can swear at it, you can kick it even, and yet it still comes back to you, wagging its tail, eyes all soft and gooey, looking adoringly up at you, head lowered a bit, the wagging tail tucked in slightly to show submission, hoping you won't kick it yet again, but doesn't get in the huff and say, "I'm leaving," and run away because you kicked it. You can mistreat a dog and yet it still stays loyal and stuck to you and open to you. Some would say that dog loves you. And given my definition of love, I wouldn't quibble with that. A human being, when it is in love, accepts anything and everything its partner cares to toss in its direction. But as soon as the mind starts to fall out of love, then in comes the value judgment. He shouldn't be like this. He should be different. He should treat me differently. He should get his bandy legs fixed. They're ugly. No longer does she refer, with a laugh, to his little ways. The way he picks his teeth after dinner. The way he gets irritable and shouts at her after he's had too many drinks. No longer does she refer to his little ways, in a tone of voice that clearly shows a delight and an acceptance of his peculiar foibles. Now his little ways irritate her. Once the value judgments of what should or shouldn't take place between them creep in, then the voice is harsh, demanding its rights. The mind has closed down. It's no longer open. It's no longer soft. It's no longer accepting. No longer seeing the lover as a new experience every time they meet. He's now stale. He's known. Confined to a compartment in her mind where she labels him, "Mr. Smith, my husband. He looks like that and he behaves like this. But he should look like this and he should behave like this." She's harsh and critical, trying to mold him into an image she can love. For the mind yearns to be soft and accepting and not judgmental once again, like it used to be in the early days of their relationship. She feels if she can only get him to change, then she will recapture that love that she once experienced and for which she constantly yearns. And this soft, accepting, non-judgmental state of mind is what the perfect teacher is always driving the student towards. The meditation is a technique which considerably in developing this attitude of mind. It is only when the mind is open and accepting as a permanent state that the meditator will truly let come in and go out everything from tension to calm, from turmoil to bliss, from physical well-being to physical pain. Only when the mind is accepting will the meditator allow all the opposites to form and disintegrate, and form and disintegrate again, without making any movement to interfere with that process. Such a state of mind is truly the mind in love. The mind saturated with love fully experiences the opposite. It fully experiences the hurt and the bliss. It's not dulled to them, but it makes no movement towards interfering with their creation and death. The mind in love is soft, it's pliant, it's patient, and totally harmless to itself and others. Thank you.